AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.
Okie dokie, greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, May Day, Sunday, May 1st, 2011, here in WILL AM 580. Today we have as our guest someone who's been on the show several times before, and I hope we'll be on it several times again. When the list is made of the top media critics and really media educators, popular media educators of the last quarter century, in the first tier will have to be included our guest, Jeff Cohen, founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, one of the top media critics and writers in the nation, joining us for the full hour today on Media Matters. But before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
By the end of this year, more than half of Americans will own a smartphone, and they will become targets for mobile marketers with access to massive amounts of information about their finances, health, and habits. And if AT&T is allowed to merge with T-Mobile, the new company will have an unprecedented ability to harvest information and influence behaviors, spending patterns, and even political action.
AT&T recognizes that mobile phones are not just a medium for communications or even to deliver you an ad. Mobile phones are about to become mobile wallets, mobile credit cards.
Jeffrey Chester is the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy. He wrote a letter to the Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communications Commission asking the agencies to address the issue of mobile marketing and consumer privacy as they consider the merger. He says AT&T and Verizon have already invested heavily in technology that allows you to pay for items using your phone instead of a credit card and turns mobile devices into powerful tracking, profiling, and targeting machines.
This is going to give AT&T a tremendous capability to gain minute and detailed information about consumers.
Chester says mobile marketing is much more than knowing where you are. It merges the behavioral profiling, what you do and where you go online, with your location and also what your friends are doing.
It's another part of why AT&T is interested in expanding its domination of the market is that increasingly people are taking their social networks with them wherever they go.
The merger would give AT&T even more power to influence entire networks of people, in many cases without their knowledge. That's because mobile marketing is designed to make users opt into this information gathering without truly understanding what is being collected and stored and how it's being used. Chester says that by 2015, the mobile commerce industry will be spending $45 billion a year just on targeting consumers in the neighborhoods where they live.
The AT&T T-Mobile deal is about ensuring that AT&T can gain a significant stranglehold over an important part of consumer data so it can battle with Google for the future of mobile marketing in the United States.
Where is the labor beat in America? It's a question that has only been brought to the forefront as the labor struggles in the Midwest have gained national attention. During a panel discussion at the National Conference for Media Reform earlier this month in Boston, prominent labor historians, activists, and journalists discussed the connection between the media and the labor movement. Granville Williams is a longstanding member of the UK-based media reform group, the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom. Williams said that for the past 6 years in the U.S., coverage of unions and labor issues on mainstream news networks made up less than 0.1% of the content.
Now, think about it. Although it's millions of people facing cutbacks, closures, unemployment, all of the things that people struggle with, and it's invisible. I have to tell you, there was one channel, however, where it wasn't invisible. Fox News carried the highest proportion of stories about trade unions and labour. And as you can guess, it was unremittingly hostile, negative coverage.
John Nichols is the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. He lamented that the framing of labour issues has led to widespread misunderstanding of public sentiment.
The baseline for the last 30 years was spin. It was fantasy. It was a lie.
And our media, not just the New York Times, certainly not just Fox and Rush Limbaugh, the whole of our media, our mainstream media system, accepted the lie, incorporated the lie into all its coverage, and created the fantasy that Americans don't like unions, that Americans don't like teachers in particular, think they're paid too much. All the things that you've heard, they're all false. They were never real, and yet they existed as an absolute truth in our media.
Mike Elk, a labor reporter for In These Times magazine, spoke about a Honeywell plant in Metropolis, Illinois, where there has been an ongoing lockout at the uranium enrichment facility after workers told the EPA about radioactive leaking into the Ohio River.
There have been explosions. There have been releases of HF6 gas into the atmosphere. There have been releases of toxic material overflowing directly into the Ohio River. And you probably haven't heard about this, because most editors find local labor struggles boring.
Elk warned of the dangers not just to public safety, but to workers protecting their right to organize when the press fails to cover these stories.
When a corporation is able to lock out or abuse its workers in one place, it sends a signal to every corporation down the line that we can push these guys around and they can take it.
To hear the rest of the panel, visit freepress.net/conference.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Today we've got a live show for you, so get ready to go to the phone lines. And before I introduce my guest, I want to tell a story about how I first met him. About 25 years ago, I was going to graduate school at the University of Washington in Seattle, and Alexander Coburn, who then was a columnist for The Nation, still is, but was more prominent at that point, and probably the leading media critic of The Nation, was on a speaking tour, and he was speaking at the University of Washington, so I went to it. And his opening act, his warm-up speaker that night, was our guest on today's show. And he gave a brief introduction of to media issues and said that he was going to start a group called Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And this group was going to go after things like the America show that had just aired on network television about ostensible Soviet takeover of the United States with the assistance of the United Nations, a very controversial program at the time. And I was so taken with the intelligence of the speaker that I became a member of FAIR and have been following him closely and proud now to call him a good friend and perhaps the smartest media critic in the country, certainly in the first tier of any list I could see constructed. So with that introduction, allow me to bring onto the air with us now Jeff Cohen, the director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College and the founder of Fairness and Accuracy Reporting. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Bob.
Well, let's get right started, Jeff, with FAIR, because I know last week, which was, I think, must have been an emotional moment for you, FAIR enjoyed its 25th anniversary, and there was a huge celebration in New York City. Let's talk a little bit about celebration first, just to give a taste of you know, what happened in New York. So it was really one of the most extraordinary events in recent years, and then we'll talk a little bit more about FAIR.
Okay, yeah, we had a great 25th birthday at the Symphony Hall space, 760 people. Our speakers were Glenn Greenwald, the blogger, Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!, Noam Chomsky, and then Michael Moore.
Sounds like our guest list.
Yeah.
Or our desired guest list in the case of Michael Moore.
Yeah. And everyone, you know, the speakers just were having the time of their lives. Michael Moore ended the event by singing happy birthday, leading, you know, hundreds of people in a singing of happy birthday to the current FAIR staff. I left the FAIR staff more than a decade ago. And I don't know, a good time was had by all. Noam Chomsky and Michael Moore had never met. Backstage, the two of them are posing for pictures, and Noam is saying, "Oh, my grandkids are going to love this. Make sure you send me the photos. You know, send them to my email." And, you know, it was great. Amy had a lot of time with Noam backstage. The people in the audience had a lot of time to schmooze with the speakers. It was just a good time to look back at 25 years. I mean, I opened my introduction of Noam Chomsky by pointing out that every week someone comes up to me and congratulates me for the brilliant last fair action alert or how great the last issue of Extra is. And, you know, I left more than a decade ago, so I really relish the completely, totally undeserved compliments I get every week. But it's a staff that's basically six full-time people that churns out that work every day. And I found myself reading Common Dreams over the weekend, and it had a wonderful story about how Obama had punished a San Francisco Chronicle reporter for the crime of having covered that protest at a Obama fundraiser. You know, the White House was acting in retribution against a Chronicle reporter because she videotaped the protest in defense of Bradley Manning, the alleged WikiLeaks leaker. And there was this kind of retribution. I'm reading this article. I said, wow, this is well written. Until I get to the bottom, I didn't realize I was reading another one of FAIR's, you know, multiple content production results of that day. You know, they're putting out content in so many different formats. And it's a staff basically of six people. And I think the fact that all of these speakers showed up is a testament to the great work done by this very talented small staff trying to keep an eye not just on the right-wing crazies in the media like Fox News and talk radio, but what's wrong with the New York Times, what's wrong with NPR, what's wrong with PBS, what's wrong with Time Magazine, and FAIR does that day after day at FAIR.org.
And I should add, for full disclosure, that I am on the board of Fairness in Action Reporting. Although I should also add in full disclosure that I'm the worst board member in history. I don't think I've ever been to a meeting or talked to anyone about it. So.
I think a group like that is so staff-centric and is so highly performing for such a small budget doesn't need a whole lot of staff supervision after 25 years.
Yeah, and we should add about Fairness in Action Reporting, for people unfamiliar with the work, listeners unfamiliar with it, the primary outreach is through the website, which is fair.org, and through the magazine Extra. Is that still in print, or is it now purely?
Oh, yeah. No, it's coming out every month.
No, I get it, but I thought there was some discussion of switching it to purely print or online.
Well, you would know better than me because you're still on the board, but I've never heard that. And
okay,
I'm finding the monthly magazine is as useful as ever.
That's right. And then there's the email blast, which are probably how most people familiar with FAIR are staying in regular touch. And talk a little bit about those.
Well, that's fascinating to me because, you know, everyone was asking me for my remembrance and my looking back on 25 years of FAIR. I remember when the fax machine was a revolutionary invention because prior to the fax machine, we would say we'd be upset by something at NBC News. We'd send a letter to NBC News. It would get there the next day or two. Maybe we would get a response 5 or 8 or 10 days later. Sometimes we'd have to send them a second letter. And when the fax machine came in, and I don't know if you remember that, you know, it had sort of people talk about the addictive qualities of computers. The fax machine was this kind of thing where if you heard something coming in on your fax machine, and you weren't expecting a fax, there was such a curiosity factor. So we got in the habit with the fax machine of faxing people right during the news show. We would watch the NBC Nightly News and CBS Evening News and ABC World News Tonight, and we'd send a fax. And I can remember a couple times where we just got totally under Tom Brokaw's skin. And within 5 minutes, we get a fax back from Brokaw himself. And, you know, we had some friends inside some of these places, and we had really good fax numbers. So for us, that was a revolutionary thing. Now, you know, we had this email alert system where FAIR has always specialized in getting around itself hundreds and hundreds of talented letter writers and talented media critics. A lot of academics or a lot of very sharp social activists have been with FAIR for years, and they write brilliant letters and emails. And so with the advent of email action alerts, in the space of 10 hours or 6 hours or 4 hours, FAIR was able to send out an alert documenting something that the New York Times had done. And FAIR, which you know, is very ethical in letting media targets respond to criticism and making sure that the item criticized is fully represented. So FAIR, when they send out an action alert, will always have a link to the item they're criticizing. And FAIR would, within a few hours of sending out an action alert, say about a New York Times abomination, the Times would sometimes get 1,000 emails within a few hours, individually written. FAIR's never believed in this, you know, they write it and everyone just signs their name, or, you know, so they give the facts, people write their own individual email, and it really can shake up places like the New York Times, places like NPR. So the action alert, if you go to FAIR.org and sign up to get the action alerts, you'll be joining a very powerful, very smart, very not about name-calling the media team, army, if you will, nonviolent army, that's really smartly criticizing mainstream media, sometimes getting corrections and changes made.
Our guest today, you're listening to right now, Jeff Cohen, the founder of Fairness in Action Reporting, currently the head of the Park Center for Independent Media. We're going to be talking about news media coverage of politics, the shape of the news media, the state of independent media, the whole waterfront of issues. But I want to finish up, if we can, before we do that, Jeff, and go to the other issues, we'll talk a little bit more about FAIR. And I want to give you a chance to respond to a common mainstream criticism of FAIR that I've heard, and not just FAIR. This would also, I think, apply to, say, Amy Goodman. She gets the same criticism, which is that what FAIR does is just the left side of the spectrum to what right-wing media critics do. And, you know, FAIR is to, you know, so there's the right-wing critics, okay, the media are too liberal, and FAIR's job is to say they're too conservative, and they're both just pushing their own agendas.
Well,
And just how do you deal with that criticism?
Yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt it's always that criticism's always going to be made. It was made on day one of FAIR's founding. You know, the first time we put anything out, what are you, the flip side of AIM? I mean, there's a lot of differences. FAIR is the most well-documented media criticism group in American history. No group has done the kind of academic studies that FAIR has done. FAIR doesn't just put labels on the media, conservative or this or that. FAIR documents who's on the air, who isn't on the air, what's being said, how many times has this distortion been said by the New York Times, on what dates. You know, there's no group until FAIR that was doing systematic studies of who gets to speak on NPR's national news, who gets to speak on the PBS NewsHour, who doesn't get to speak on NPR and PBS. When New York Times was, when NAFTA was the big issue, FAIR did a very thorough study of what sources were quoted by the New York Times and the Washington Post in their allegedly objective news reporting. And as usual, the corporate side was overrepresented, the union side was underrepresented, the pro-NAFTA side was overrepresented, the critics under. Every single study FAIR has done has shown a slight bias toward Republicans over Democrats in terms of sourcing, a huge bias of right-wing think tanks over left-wing think tanks, a huge bias in favor of corporate representatives over labor or consumer rights or environmental or anti-war representatives. So when you've done that kind of systematic studying that FAIR has done now for 25 years, including 10 years after I left, it's pretty hard to say, well, all FAIR is doing is what these right-wing groups are doing, which is trying to pressure and shove the media to be so hounded by pressure that the media are afraid to tell the full story. That's just not what FAIR has ever done. You know, most of the right-wing groups, and one could argue the new liberal group, Media Matters, are very much party organizations, you know, lining up with one or the other political party. And their goal with journalists is to do what the head of the Republican Party said he was trying to do, Rich Bond, a few years ago, the chair of the National Republican Committee. He said, yeah, when you're beating up on the media, it's like a basketball coach working the refs. You yell and yell, and you hope the next time the ref will be soft on you. I think that's a FAIR criticism of a lot of media watch organizations. I think that FAIR has distinguished itself as pushing the ball forward on media research, documentation of bias. By now, after 25 years, when I see that FAIR has done a new study, and again, I haven't been on the staff for more than a decade, when I see FAIR has done a new study, I have a good sense that of what has come before, and the overwhelming mounting evidence that FAIR develops is something that cannot be argued with. And whenever I am in a debate or a liberal reporter who's trying to be in the middle of the road, well, how are you different than AIM on the right wing or Media Research Center on the right wing? I have a simple response. How many studies have they ever done of who gets sourced on TV, radio, or in newspapers? How many studies have they ever done? Mm-hmm. And the answer is zero. They have never done any of these studies. Because if they look at who gets to, you know, the myth of objective journalism, Bob, as you know as well as anyone, is that somehow objective journalism is a fair and comprehensive representation of reality. All objective journalism has come to mean in U.S. corporate media is the reporter, him or herself, can say, my own opinion wasn't in there. So the opinions that are in objective journalism in today's corporate media in our country are those experts, those sources, those policymakers, those think tank representatives, those corporate representatives that are quoted. They are allowed to give their opinion. And whenever you do those kinds of surveys of allegedly objective news, whether it's NPR or New York Times or Washington Post, you see that the bias is in a corporate, conservative, elite direction. And no right-wing media watch group has ever done any of those source studies because it would blow away the whole game. It would expose the whole charade that that our kind of criticism, which is actually well-documented and socially scientific in a certain way, is reflecting what's really happening in terms of mainstream media content. And what right-wing groups do especially is, if there's someone on the air somewhere who's raising questions about the right-wing orthodoxy, then they call that liberal bias and run a campaign against them. And there's no sense on the, there's no mission on the right wing to be comprehensive about the whole media sphere, and that's what FAIR does. FAIR is particularly critical of these dominant outlets that are seen by the right wing as liberal and seen by the mainstream as centrist. You could call them corporate centrist liberal if you want, but I'm talking about New York Times, PBS, NPR, and shows the real elite corporate conservative biases of those allegedly liberal outlets.
Our guest today, you've just been listening to, Jeff Cohen, the founder of Fairness in Accessing Reporting, currently the head of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. The phone number here at Media Matters is 217-333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The phone lines are open. Jeff Cohen, among other things, has been a longtime journalist and author of media books and articles, and probably as knowledgeable on media and the news as anyone I know. Jeff, let's talk a little bit about another stage of your career that pertains to what's going on in media today very directly, which is when you left Fairness in Accessing Reporting, you were in the process of moving into cable television news. Yeah. And over the course of your 10 or 15 years, you worked for CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News. You had various gigs with all three of them. So you were, in a way, almost present at the creation for the cable news system that now really dominates sort of public discourse on national politics in the United States. You know, what did you learn from your experience at those three networks that you think, you know, you've written about it in your book, Cable News Confidential, but in shorthand, what did you learn that probably most people wouldn't know, that that experience taught you to appreciate and understand about cable news that the someone just watching the shows wouldn't quite get?
Well, one thing is that the operative word, you said watching the shows, the operative word in a cable news show or TV news show is show, that it's basically show business. They basically have a star system. It's mostly about performance. I was a senior producer at MSNBC, so the next morning after the night show, we would all get the ratings, and you could see where the ratings went up in this 15-minute period, and it went down in that 15-minute segment. So I think that's one thing that people have to keep in mind, is how much of it is showbiz. And another thing is just this, corollary of that it's, you know, the operative word in TV news show is show. The corollary is shows need stars. And the way that plays out in terms of politics is that the management at a cable news channel, they want you to get the biggest stars you can get. And that means they want you to get the top White House people. They want you to get the secretaries of state and defense. And if you ran on your channel actual independent journalism, critical of the two parties or critical of the party that happens to have the White House, you will not get those stars. And everyone knows it. I think the TV viewers didn't realize it maybe till the last few years, with, you know, MSNBC sort of gone Democrat and Fox News has always been Republican. It became clearer that they have two different guest lists. But prior to that development, I was at MSNBC in 2002 and 2003. And, you know, there was this huge thing, this huge fear on the part of management that because the Phil Donahue show in primetime at MSNBC was having this dissent, people that were skeptical and critical and opposed to the invasion of Iraq, because of that, it was affecting the ability of MSNBC to get the stars on from the Bush administration. And I think when you look at the internal memo traffic at MSNBC among management, you can see that was a big fright, that we were offending the White House. And so so that's the other thing people need, this demand for access. The New York Times in print, they want to be able to quote the top people. And if they're too, you know, independent, their articles will be lacking in the quotes of Secretary of State Colin Powell or Hillary Clinton. And that's a bridge too far for them. And go from print to television where, you know, everyone can see, okay, this channel is interviewing the Secretary of State, and this other channel is interviewing someone from a think tank that I've never heard of or seen on TV before. And in management circles and TV news, that star power means we want the Secretary of State, whoever happens to be in power, which means we will not be too critical of foreign policy. I would argue that MSNBC is appalling today in its analysis of U.S. foreign policy. It is ridiculous. It is propagandistic.
Even the liberal shows?
Including the liberal shows, especially the liberal shows. I think that the coverage of Libya has been completely, vapid. Coverage of the longest war in U.S. history in Afghanistan is almost nil on MSNBC. And it's, you know, it's that cardinal rule that you, Bob, have talked about for years, and Chomsky before us, and, you know, that, you know, U.S. foreign policy covered in mainstream media, it's often a bipartisan consensus, and certainly with the MSNBC having a Democrat engaged in three wars in Muslim countries, the coverage is appallingly thin. It's appallingly uncritical. And that's the beauty of truly independent media, which is where people need to go if they want to hear independent experts and a more intelligent discourse about the dangers of the Libya operation and the, you know, the quagmire of Afghanistan. You just won't get it on MSNBC, that's for sure. And it's that coziness, you know, MSNBC is cozy with one sector of the governing elite, and Fox News is cozier with the other sector. But independent, neither of those channels are.
Our guest, Jeff Cohn, founder of Fairness in Action Reporting, currently the head of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. Phone lines here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455. The toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller, who's been waiting patiently. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, I mainly listen to NPR and try to be critical of it, and it's not hard. The latest quip is that NPR doesn't stand for anything anymore. You know, it literally doesn't. I don't know why public is offensive. But I had a broader question, but a specific thing. NPR's person who is a woman whose name escapes me at this point, who is their health care coverage, was on one of these Week in the Review roundups, and she was asked about the single-payer system in Vermont, and is anybody else talking about that? And I was waiting, and she said no. And I just, you know, it's shocking. It was passed twice in California. It only, you know, whether they were really expecting passed it because they knew the Terminator would veto it, I don't know. But it passed twice. It's been put forward in Illinois. There are other states where single payer. I know FAIR has done an actual analysis, I believe. I don't know how widespread of the coverage of single payer. But it was just absolutely shocking. And I haven't sent out a complaint about it because I'd be doing it all the time.
Well, I encourage you. I would encourage you to do that. Are you referring perhaps to Julie Rovner?
Yeah. Nobody else is talking about single payer, apparently. And when it passed twice. Another thing, Seth Jolly was at the conference. I didn't attend, but I heard some interviews done with him. And he mentioned an early document that was basically, you know, you can't say it caused the corporate campaign against media. But I was shocked to hear that it was written by who went on to be our liberal Supreme Court Justice, Lewis Powell. Do you know about that memo?
Oh, yeah.
And I guess assume it was when he was in the Nixon administration, right?
Well, caller, should we let Jeff take over? Do you have some more you'd like to add?
No. Thank you for your time.
Well, Bye. Thank you for the great question. And, the famous Lewis Powell memo. Jeff, you want to take that?
Yeah, some great questions. Lewis Powell actually wrote that memo for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and it was written in the 1970s.
1971.
Right, and there was this fear that too much democracy was breaking out in our country, and that the systems of power and economic and political power were being questioned by young activists and black activists and women activists. And so Powell wrote this memo. I talked about it at length in a segment on the Real News Network. But he, you know, it was how the corporate sector has got to organize itself to set up institutions that can defend itself against the outbreak of democracy. That was sort of the gist of it. And it led, one could argue, to a lot of funds in the next few years being raised to set up right-wing think tanks, right-wing media watch groups, and to try to counter the threat of democracy and the threat of skepticism about our political economic system that had grown out of all the movements of the 1960s. And when you look back at the Lewis Powell memo, and you realize all the institutions that were built even within 10 years, it's pretty scary how, I mean, this was the beginning. We now talk about the Koch brothers every week. But the Lewis Powell memo was really an important memo. You can find it on Wikipedia. It's really instructive to see. And one of their concerns was that new left sensibilities might spill over into other into academia and media circles, and that trend had to be stopped. And by the way, that did not surface, that memo, until he'd been approved to be on the Supreme Court. Had it surfaced, it's unlikely he would have been confirmed for the Supreme Court. It was such a purely political memo, not exactly the kind of writing you expect. You know, you expect that kind of writing from Karl Rove, not from a judge who's ready to be on the Supreme Court. Or
at least back in those days.
Yeah, yes. The other question that really intrigues me is NPR and health care. FAIR did a lot in the first fight for health care reform in the modern era, which was during the Clinton era. And during that time, NPR, similarly, there were 100 members of Congress that were supporting a very simple plan of Medicare for all. It was then led by Congressman McDermott from the state of Washington, who was then, I believe, one of two physicians in the House. So in the early, in the 1990s, there was this huge movement for single-payer health care that was very well represented in Congress. And we can look now and see that what Hillary Clinton did with her health care task force in the early 90s was, and it was pretty explicit, they were trying to come up with a plan that would avoid any move toward a single-payer national health insurance plan. In other words, Medicare for All, where private insurance wouldn't figure in to health care system. And at that time, where there was this upsurge, I can remember attending community meetings, and I don't, I live in upstate New York. There were meetings in district after district across the country for single payer. And when it would be discussed on NPR, they would have, as they like to do on NPR, have a discussion purporting to be a broad swath of the American political spectrum. A former Republican Congress member, he was named Downing. Democrat, Downing, and a former Republican member of Congress, his name was Vin Weber, and they would have a discussion, and both of them would dismiss single payer together, and they would always be introduced as, and we have our former Democrat member of Congress, our former Republican member of Congress, and what NPR would never tell its listeners is that both of them were lobbyists for the corporate health insurance interest. Both of them were lobbyists or consultants for corporate health care. And it wasn't until FAIR got money to put an ad in the New York Times that they ever told their listeners what they all knew, which is that these guys don't just have a past. What's more relevant when you introduce a guest is to introduce their present. And their present is that they were lobbyists and consultants for corporate health care. And NPR, until we ran a big campaign and raised enough money to put an ad in the New York Times, they would not do it. And so, I mean, when I look at the trend from back in the early 90s to today, to what this caller is complaining about, where they still won't cover the only simple way that every study has proven that could bring down our health care costs and make it affordable for everyone and make it accessible for everyone, which is enhanced Medicare for All. If you can't even get that discussed on public radio, what is public radio about?
Jeff Cohen, let me ask you, shifting gears just slightly, going back to what we were talking about with cable TV news, mm-hmm. You know, how important in your view is Fox News, Ben, to the success of the political right nationally in elections and also in sort of dominating the Republican Party?
I think Fox News, where I was every week for 5 years on their media criticism show called Newswatch, I think Fox News is one of the most important players in the American right and in American politics. And if Lewis Powell in his 1971 memo could have only predicted cable news, he would have called for a Fox News channel. And I don't think there's a way of underestimating the impact of Fox News. It makes and breaks presidential candidates. It puts issues into American discourse that would not be in American discourse. They can take any fringe idea and mainstream it. They have huge influence over Rush Limbaugh and the whole talk radio horde. So they have that multiplier effect. If you listen to Limbaugh, you'll hear him referring to Fox News, and he's watching it while he's doing his show. It's basically, to have an ideological, there have always been ideological publications in the history of our country, National Review and The Nation and what have you. But to have an ideological TV channel on 24/7, it was really a breakthrough. And as I wrote about it in my book, I was there in the first 5 years of Fox News. As I wrote about it in the book, when Rupert Murdoch, the owner of Fox News, hired Roger Ailes to be the Fox News chair, and Roger Ailes, of course, is not a journalist, never has been a journalist, I think what was going through Rupert Murdoch's mind is, look at this guy, Ailes. Look what he can do in a 30-second attack ad against a Democrat. Imagine what this guy could do with a TV channel 24/7. And Ailes is a brilliant guy, and he did a great job with it, and he keeps doing a great job with it. And there's nothing on the left until we have complete the kind of media reform, Bob, that you've talked about for decades, where we have an actual free press and and electronic media isn't just dominated by six big corporations. Until we get to that point, there will never be anything on the left.
Well, before we get back to the phone lines, which are open at 217-333-9455 and toll-free 1-800-222-9455, before we get to the phone lines, we have a caller waiting. I just want to – one other point about the cable news and Fox that I find very interesting. I'd like your take on it, if I could, Jeff Cohen, is that when I watch the liberal shows on MSNBC – Ed Schultz and Cenk Uygur and Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell, and before that, Keith Olbermann, they spend an inordinate amount of time, it seems, sort of dealing with what Fox News is saying and what political figures in the political right are saying, sort of the lunacy of sort of the right wing. And when I watch Fox News, which I do periodically, they seem to pay no attention whatsoever to MSNBC. I mean, right. It's like they couldn't care less what MSNBC is doing.
Well, I think it's indicative of the political spectrum. I mean, the at night MSNBC is the Democratic channel and Fox News is the Republican channel.
Why can't the Republicans be yelling at how dumb the Democrats are at MSNBC?
They're not that stupid because they're more strategic. And, the Fox News and the Republicans are always on the offensive, and Barack Obama and his defenders on MSNBC are always on the defensive. And the Fox News is...
Actually, I think you gave a nice short answer because that's stupid. I think we can stop right there.
Okay, all right, fine.
I think that's good. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Champagne, you're on a car phone and you're on the air with Jeff Cohen.
Hey, that was the smartest thing I've ever heard on your show just there, Mr. McChesney. And in all fairness, I know you put a lot of effort into developing some credibility for FAIR in the first few minutes of your show. And, Mr. McChesney, do your listeners know that you're an avowed Marxist?
Okay, I think we've got the drift of this phone call.
Would you speak?
I think this is absurd. Thank you, caller, for calling in with your quote of the day. Let's go to another caller right after when we get more. Lines are open at 217-333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Well, at least that caller liked your comment, Jeff.
Yeah, it's funny how sometimes there is agreement across the political spectrum on certain things that are so truthful they can't be denied, I guess.
I want to turn now to something you've written a lot about and we've talked a lot about, which is the whole WikiLeaks episode that's taken place in the last, in the last 6 or 7 months, but it's going on for the last year or two, especially when WikiLeaks has released government documents. And what is your take on WikiLeaks and how it's played out and how what it says about American journalism today?
I'm one who agrees with Glenn Greenwald on this 100%, that WikiLeaks is really illustrative of what's wrong with mainstream media today. That if journalists in corporate mainstream media define, and I include NPR and PBS in that, if they define their task as my loyalty is to the public, my job is to inform the public, my job is to expose government and corporate secrets so that the public is informed and can act intelligently in a democracy. If that's how mainstream journalists define their jobs, then they would be looking at WikiLeaks as a godsend. And in many parts of the globe, that's how mainstream journalists see WikiLeaks. They see it as an ally. They see it as a godsend. And in our country, when you look, and it's not just Fox News, look elsewhere, look at Bill Keller, at the New York Times, who's been the executive editor for years, they look at WikiLeaks and what WikiLeaks is doing, and most of U.S. media discourse sides with the government. And most of their discussion is, how does this affect our government? How does this affect national security? How does this affect our State Department? How does this affect our war effort? And if they were acting more as journalists, independent of the state. And there was this new technology. Put aside the controversial nature of Julian Assange, that's meaningless. What's important is this new technology taking government secrets that are just devastating in showing that the government line that these mainstream journalists are echoing is a lie, in from Afghanistan to Iraq to State Department diplomacy to the role of the U.S. at the United Nations. You know, if mainstream journalists in this country had a journalistic ethic that my mission is to the public, my loyalty is to the public, and I should be exposing government secrets, their orientation would be quite warm toward what WikiLeaks is doing and trying to use what those documents to help the American public understand how their government and government foreign policy operates. Instead, just look at the discourse. Look at how many articles in U.S. mainstream publications were about the threat of WikiLeaks or the risk of WikiLeaks, and how little about the content of the documents and what it says to the U.S. public about our government. I think it's one of the most illustrative events that's happened in recent American media history, showing the bankruptcy of so much of the mainstream media, is just how they reacted to WikiLeaks. And I would argue it's very different than how the mainstream media in Spain and Germany and France and even England have reacted to WikiLeaks.
Have there been heroes in American journalism, aside from Glenn Greenwald, but within the mainstream, have there been some people pushing it along, I mean, doing good work dealing with these cables and releases?
Very little. Very little. You can't find, I mean, even, you know, my critique I was making earlier of MSNBC, which is so much a Democratic Party outfit, if it was more an independent journalist outfit, it would be using these WikiLeaks documents day after day to show how the Obama administration is continuing Bush foreign policy, which can't be defended. So, you know, you'd expect people might expect me to praise MSNBC on WikiLeaks, but I watch it every night and seen a very little use of WikiLeaks documents. So I'm sure there's some in the mainstream media that have done better, but no one's coming to my mind.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines to another caller who's waiting patiently. This one from New York, line one. You're on the air with Jeff Cohen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to talk about something you were talking about again, Bob, as far as the cable news shows. But first, I'd like to mention the FAIR event that went on last Friday. You know, when I heard news that this was being live streamed on the web, to me personally, and I'm sure there were a lot of other people, it felt like, you know, the Oscars and the royal wedding rolled into one. It was such an unbelievable event. And sadly, it felt like sort of a preview or an actualization of the abstract concept of net neutrality, and that there were bandwidth problems. And essentially, it kind of disrupted and ruined that experience for a lot of people. So, you know, the idea that somehow the ratings are really what the networks want, you know, they could certainly get them with superstar panels like that, but I think it's more that advertisers have no interest in buying that. But what I wanted to ask you more specifically about is because Cenk Uygur was on Bob's program a couple weeks ago, and he spoke specifically to the fact that, you know, he feels independent and has no real, you know, conscious sense of censorship going on. And yet, you know, and the same thing I would say probably for Rachel Maddow when she first came on, but to me it feels like the longer that they're on and in that platform, they, you know, sort of unconsciously become co-opted. And, you know, you saw Rachel Maddow embedded with the U.S. Army, you know, during their press release, you know, press op staging of the exit of Iraq, of the U.S. military, that sort of thing. You know, that was sort of stunning. And then, you know, Cenk Uygur spent, you know, hour after hour after hour covering Donald Trump. And you just have to wonder, is it just because the sort of money and lifestyle associated with that position just has no way to otherwise to co-opt you? And the only people that, you know, are willing to kind of turn that away, people like Glenn Greenwald or I.F. Stone before him, are sort of the true heroes just because of that. And that it's sort of hard to imagine, you know, a world where people can, you know, turn away that kind of money or power or fame, you know, to do their job. And, you know, Walter Cronkite and even those guys were not paid and showered with the kind of celebrity lifestyle that these guys have. So if you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, caller.
You raised a number of issues. Let me just take the last one first, which is the lifestyle and the money. when I was at MSNBC, I earned, in my 1 year there, I was on air, I was partly talent and partly senior producer, I earned nearly $200,000. I'd been in the nonprofit sector where when I left FAIR, and I built FAIR for, 15 years, I left there and I was getting paid less than $40,000. So
to live in New York City.
Yes, in New York City.
Yeah.
So I want to say that was like in the late 90s. So I want to say that it is seductive. And the people that work their way into a position of power, either on air or the top producers, are, they're making a lot of money. And their kids are in private school. You get used to having your kids in private school. You get used to living in the nice neighborhoods and having the nice cars. And, when I teach journalism at Ithaca College, I talk about how sad it is that in this country, if your independent journalism is so dangerous to the powers that be, the worst thing that can happen to you is you lose your job and you lose that money. But in other countries, you do independent journalism or independent blogging, like in Egypt all those years, you lost your life. So, yes, it's seductive, but it's just money. And there's no doubt it has an impact, that the people at the top are hugely well paid. And the people at the bottom are often young people coming out of journalism schools or other schools, and they believe in independent journalism, but quickly they realize, wow, if I'm going to make it to the top, I'm going to have to play the corporate game. Of up the ladder, and the more you get higher up the ladder, the less you are a journalist and the more you are a diplomat or the more you are a politician. Now, in terms of someone in mainstream media saying, I'm completely independent, during the Bill Clinton sex scandals, you always used to hear the Democrats say, if someone says it isn't about sex, it is about sex. If someone in the mainstream media says, I'm totally independent, they're not independent. Glenn Greenwald over, with his blog, he doesn't have to tell people he's independent. You can look at the content and know he's independent. He doesn't have to protest too much. But when the people at MSNBC say they're independent, they're just joking. How much will they do on net neutrality now that Comcast is taking over, the big corporate foe of net neutrality? If we had a truly left-wing, independent TV channel, 24/7 cable news, they would have had program after program about the fact that General Electric paid no taxes on billions of dollars in corporate profit. And they would have had show after show about how at some point the corporate income tax in our national budget paid for 20, 22, 23%, 25% of our national budget, and it has fallen down sometimes to 10%, 12%. If the corporations aren't paying their taxes, then middle-class Americans are, making up the difference. So the fact that we had this big scandal on the front page of the New York Times, which was a quite good report by the Times, and there's no left-wing channel independent of General Electric that would go to town on it. I know Lawrence O'Donnell mentioned it in a segment, but that's an example of what's wrong with the American system. And if you had a truly independent 24/7 cable news channel that General Electric paid no taxes while we're in this huge deficit situation, it would have been like on any progressive independent channel, program after program after program. But MSNBC is partly owned by General Electric, and as I learned when I was there and when I was at any of these places, the ownership matters. You learn that from day one. You can talk privately about General Electric, but you're sure not going to put it on the air.
You know, Jeff, I think and we have two callers waiting patiently. We've only got like 5 minutes left. If you don't mind me interrupting, I want to get to those callers.
Okay, sure.
Let's go first to line four, Peoria, who's been waiting very patiently. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Jeff Cohen.
Hi. I was listening to you. I just brought to mind a couple of things that happened last week. First, I saw Mohamed Elberde on Charlie Rose, and during the interview, he talked about how the Iraq War was based on lies. That was he's the IAEA inspector. I think they wanted to interview him about Egypt, but he went into that and said that this needed to be investigated, that it was basically a crime. A million people may have died. And the other one was if the story about Gaddafi's son and grandchildren being killed by NATO. And I thought, man, those are huge. I'm going to watch Sunday morning and see what they have to say, because I'm sure that's going to be something. And they had, like, nothing, you know, just barely even brought it up. You know, oh, by the way, we killed the family of a leader of a country.
Right. Yeah, I think on your last point, you're making a point that's been so well documented by people like Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky, which is this concept of worthy and unworthy victims. You know, if a politician's kids are killed in our country, we will know the kids, we'll know the kids' nannies, they'll be completely humanized. When kids are killed in the Arab world, we never know who their parents are, we never meet their family, we never see their home. They're not worthy victims, because they're people that die in warfare where the U.S. or U.S. allies are responsible. And you can go back into Chomsky and Herman's work and see they've been documenting that for several decades. On El Baradei, that just fascinates me, because I agree with what was said at the fair 25th birthday by a number of the speakers, which is, if it wasn't for the New York Times, if it wasn't for Meet the Press, echoing the lies that were transparently not true, the claims coming out of the Bush-Cheney offices about why we had to invade Iraq and why we had to invade now, and everywhere the UN inspectors went, every place that was supposed to have the weapons, it was dust. There'd been no development there, no buildings there for years and years and years. And all over the world, except in our country, the mainstream media pointed out, boy, everything that the U.S. said has been proven to be a lie. But in our country, we were told by mainstream media, Washington Post, and dozens of editorials in a six-month period, why we had to invade Iraq. Front page of the New York Times not only regurgitated some of the lies coming out of Bush-Cheney, they amplified on them. So I would argue that's one of the media crimes. You look at the two biggest media stories of the last decade. One of them was all the distortions that led to this war in Iraq. The other is the Wall Street meltdown. And both of those stories were missed by the mainstream media. But people working in independent media just utterly distinguished themselves for how they got the facts right. And this is beyond ideology or philosophy or worldview. Who got the facts right on those two big stories and who didn't? And you look at the Amy Goodmans who got it right. You look at people in independent media that got it right. Bob Scheer got it right on the Wall Street meltdown. And look at who got it wrong. And who got it wrong are the big outlets with all their millions of dollars and their hundreds of journalists who just couldn't get the facts straight on the two big stories of the last decade.
Jeff Cohen, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means we just about have to wrap up here. And I want to apologize to the callers waiting patiently I didn't get a chance to get to. Jeff, any closing words on where you would tell people to go to get really good news?
Yeah, I would say if you're interested in media criticism, go to fair.org. If you want to get an independent view on news day after day, I would go to Democracy Now! I would go to commondreams.org. I would go to Truth Out! I would go to Truth Dig! I mean, there are people that are digging out the news every day. Glenn Greenwald's blog is worth looking at every single day on Salon. It frankly is a flourishing of journalism, but just in the margins.
On that note, Jeff Cohen, I'm going to have to say thanks for everything. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.
I'm Bob McChesney.
I want to thank Kyle Kroha and Melissa Trentz for engineering and producing today's show, and I'll be back with you in 167 hours. Until then, have a great week, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This is Illinois Public.